Right now, I am joined by Professor Francisco Gil White. He has been teaching at the University of Pennsylvania Psychology Department, where he's been teaching cultural and evolutionary psychology, going back to 2001. His appointment at Penn is going to end June 30th, 2006. And why was he fired from one of America's most prestigious universities? You think that instead of teaching evolutionary psychology, he was teaching creation. I don't know. What do you think could have gotten him fired? We're going to find out. He's an extraordinary man. His website is hirhome.com, and he's joining us now on Israel National Radio. Professor Francisco Gil White, welcome to Israel National Radio.
Mr. Singer, thank you for having me on.
Hey, it's great having you on, Professor. We had an opportunity to speak briefly before the broadcast. I'm reading your bio, and I'm absolutely astonished. University of Pennsylvania, I don't know the numbers. It's got to be 40, 50% Jewish. And it's a campus with a strong Jewish life. You would think that at the University of Pennsylvania, this is not Berkeley, this is a place where Jewish life thrives, and there's a lot of students there that are pretty pro-Israel. You got fired for standing up for Israel. What is this? What happened there?
That is very surprising. The school is indeed close to 40% Jewish, at least the student body is. The most represented group in the psychology department faculty are Jews. That didn't matter. I was still fired for defending the Jewish people. Now, the structure of this is actually stranger than might appear at first, because the person who directly threatened me at first, Professor Paul Rosen, is also Jewish. And the man responsible for orchestrating my firing, that's political science professor Ian Lustig, also claims to be Jewish. And the dean of the School of Arts and Sciences, who put his stamp on all this, Dean Samuel Preston, also is Jewish. But in fact, this is normal. It is only strange to those who don't know, for example, the history of World War II. During World War II, as we have documented on the website, a great, great, great many mainstream Jewish leaders in the United States, when the Holocaust had already begun, devoted all of their energies to sabotage the effort of Peter Bergson. He was the political leader of the Irgun Zwei Leumi, and he was also the nephew of the chief rabbi in Jerusalem. Well, this Peter Bergson, when the Holocaust had already begun, and everybody knew about it, it was news all over the world that the Jews in Europe were being exterminated, Peter Bergson went to the United States to try to organize a movement that would put pressure on the United States government to create a rescue effort for the Jews in Europe who still lived at the time, which was about 4 million. So he went there expecting to find support among the Jewish leadership in the United States. But in fact, the mainstream Jewish leaders, I'm not speaking about the Orthodox rabbis, because the Orthodox rabbis actually joined the Peter Bergson movement. I'm speaking of the some of the very important Reform rabbis, like Stephen Wise. Stephen Wise, people like Nahum Goldman, the Jews who had high positions of leadership in the U.S. government, in the Roosevelt administration, or in the Senate. Great majority of those Jews who were the most powerful in the U.S. establishment actually allied with the anti-Semites and did everything they could to sabotage the Bergson effort, which all Bergson was trying to do was save as many Jewish lives as he could in the middle of the Holocaust. And this is a big problem that we have today, those of us who want to prevent the destruction of Israel, because it's not only happening at the level of mainstream Jewish leaders in diaspora organizations in the United States and Jewish leaders who today have positions of power in the U.S. government. They're all putting their effort behind the attack on Israel. They've been assisting the Oslo process. They've been apologizing for the PLO, et cetera, et cetera. But, of course, it's not purely a U.S. Phenomenon. We also have the Jews who are in positions of leadership in the Israeli government, cleansing the Jews out of Gaza, and now Olmert wants to cleanse the Jews out of the West Bank, or Judea and Samaria, and give all of this territory to the PLO. So we have across the board this phenomenon that is surprising only to those who don't pay attention to the facts and have not studied World War II, but is in fact a recurrent phenomenon in history that those Jews who attain positions of leadership in countries where Gentiles, who are tend to be anti-Semitic, dominate, they tend to join with those Gentiles and attack the Jews. Now, the thing that is very strange, at least initially to me, was to find that the leadership of the Israeli government was assisting the destruction of the Jewish state. That, to me, initially was shocking. But it does fit the general pattern.
Yeah, well, all you have to do, Professor, is go to the New York Times any day, and you'll see Israel slandered there, portrayed as though it was some sort of apartheid state. It's the only democracy in the Middle East.
Yes, it's absurd. I mean, it's, Israel is one of the most compassionate states in the world.
Yeah, I mean, frankly, I would invite any Arab in the world can walk down the streets of Tel Aviv, of Jerusalem, with the kufi on, with the whole Islamic outfit on. No one's going to harm you. If I, as a Jew, if I put on a yarmulke, a skull cap, walk down as an Orthodox Jew down the streets of Damascus, Riyadh, I'd be killed immediately. I mean, there's nothing to talk about. And, you know, I'm so glad you brought up Stephen Weiss, who could have saved thousands and maybe even more Jews. Opportunities were made available to him. But, frankly, the Jews of Eastern Europe weren't important to him. They weren't the elite German Jews. The New York Times, all Jews, back then, they knew about the genocide. They were silent about it. They were silent about the genocide during the Holocaust. They were silent about
the
Ukrainian
genocide. Well, yeah, actually, the New York Times, which was run and is still run by the Sulzberger family, would constantly shunt news about the Holocaust to the back pages. The record of the New York Times during the Holocaust is dismal. I mean, dismal. Israel National News, of course, has experienced persecution at the hands of the Israeli government. For what? For telling the truth that defends the Jewish people.
And if you're just joining us now, my guest is Dr. Gil White. He doesn't just have a PhD, a doctorate in evolutionary psychology, and I don't even know what that means. But he's a leading scholar in this field. And as you can imagine, if he was given professorship at the University of Pennsylvania, that's an Ivy League campus, one of the finest universities in the world, as you can imagine, he is part of that academic elite. I need to ask you this question before we even go into the subject that I want to speak about. You study psychology. Can you help me understand what it is about the academic world? I mean, these are not stupid people. These are, you know, high IQ folks. Why are they overwhelmingly so anti-Israel? Obviously, there are many pro-Israel professors, not only in the United States, but around the world, the United Kingdom. There's a whole group. We're going to bring them on, Academics for Israel. But they're an anomaly. What is so toxic about the academic elite, which you're a part of? What's wrong with them?
The first hypothesis that I came up with when I began getting threatened for defending Israel was that, let me backtrack a second. In order to answer your question, I'd like to make clear what it is that I was fired for, because that will actually shed a little bit of light on your question in a way that I think is very useful. The piece that got my superiors at the University of Pennsylvania very upset was an article that documents the history of the PLO. And in this article, I show that the PLO was the controlling core of the PLO, which is called Al-Fatah, which was Arafat's organization from the start, was created by a leader of Adolf Hitler's Final Solution. And the purpose was to continue the extermination of the Jewish people. Around 1970, Al-Fatah swallowed the PLO and took it over and kept the name. But the PLO is essentially Al-Fatah. In other words, the PLO is an organization created by a leader of the Final Solution with the purpose of continuing the extermination of the Jewish people. The PLO is the Nazis. And it is the Nazis that are going to be, that now have Gaza and will soon have Judea and Samaria. So when I found this out, it completely changed my position on the Arab-Israeli conflict. Before realizing this, I was pro-PLO. I was consuming all of the propaganda that everybody else consumes in the mass media. And
so
I had
you
not
were
done
on
any...
you were on the other side. You,
I was
you
on the
used
other
to
side.
Be,
I,
you used
I
to be a leftist.
Done... I'm sorry?
I mean, whatever. You used to be, we'll just call it a leftist. You used to be anti-Israel.
Exactly. I was a standard liberal leftist. And
what
and
turned you around? I'm
finding this out. The first thing that got me thinking was when the allegations against the Israelis in the town of Jenin, right? There was an allegation, I believe it was April 2002, the Israeli government was accused of conducting a massacre of Arab civilians in the town of Jenin. And with very little research, it became obvious that allegations had to be false. The UN refugee camp in Jenin, as the BBC had documented already, had a bombs-making factory and an arms-making factory of the PLO. And it was also from Jenin that the great majority of suicide bombers were leaving from to go kill innocent civilians in Israel. So it was obvious that that the IDF had gone there to fight a nest of terrorists. And as we now know, because everybody who accused the IDF of conducting a massacre there has now retracted the accusation, the IDF was actually very careful to protect civilians. The PLO, by contrast, was using Arab civilians as bait so that they could lure the Israeli soldiers into different kinds of booby traps that they had set in the refugee camps in order to kill them. So the Israeli Defense Forces was much more careful to protect Arab civilian life than the PLO was. The PLO was actually deliberately endangering Arab civilian life in order to kill Israeli soldiers. So, which is, of course, the PLO policy. I mean, they strap bombs around young children in order to kill other children, right? This is their standard policy. So when we found out that it was obvious that there had been no massacre in Jenin, and yet, despite how obvious this was, the entire mainstream Western media and elsewhere was accusing the Israelis of a massacre. This really got us thinking that there was something very strange about the media with respect to the Arab-Israeli conflict. And that's when I began to wonder. At the time, I was working at Emperor's Close, and my colleague Jared Israel is the one who initially noticed how strange this accusation was and got us both thinking about the Arab-Israeli conflict in a new way. And as a result of shifting our perspective and doing more research on the Arab-Israeli conflict, I eventually found out that Haji Amin al-Husseini, who had been before the Second World War, the Mufti of Jerusalem, because the British Mandate government installed him as the Mufti of Jerusalem, from that position, he had been organizing terrorist riots against innocent Jews, one after another. And then when the World War exploded, he met with Hitler in 1941. Hitler promised him that he would invade the Middle East and exterminate all the Jews who lived in the Middle East and then make Haji Amin al-Husseini the king. And Haji Amin al-Husseini, very grateful, then went to Bosnia, where he organized tens of thousands of Bosnian Muslim volunteers in very large divisions of the SS that went around Yugoslavia hunting for Serbs, Jews, and Gypsies, murdering them in their homes or sending them to the vast concentration camp system known as Jasenovac in Croatia, where they were murdered. The children were raped first. Now, this Haji Amin al-Husseini then also did diplomacy in order to get the hundreds of thousands of Hungarian Jews sent to Auschwitz. And he was also responsible for accelerating the death process in the death camps with gas chambers and so forth. So Haji Amin al-Husseini is one of the great architects of Adolf Hitler's final solution. And this is the man who created earlier had created the Arab Higher Committee in Jerusalem, which Arab Higher Committee created al-Fatah, Yasser Arafat's organization. And Haji Amin al-Husseini also was the mentor, personal mentor to Yasser Arafat. So a great architect of Adolf Hitler's final solution was behind the creation of the PLO, of what is now the PLO. When I realized this, then my entire picture of the Arab-Israeli conflict was turned upside down.
One of the reasons why this all becomes so interesting is that the president of Iran has declared, a very interesting message, he's declared that on the one hand the Holocaust never happened, And on the other hand, he says, look, if you believe that there was a Holocaust, you Europeans are the ones who committed these crimes that we deny occurred. And therefore, why should the Palestinian people have to pay for the crimes of Europe? Take the Jews, move them to Europe. So everything we're discussing goes to everything that's happening in the world around us. My guest, Professor Francisco Gil White, University of Pennsylvania. Professor, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mr. Singer.
Hey, great having you on. Just as a point, and a number of listeners that actually asked this question, when you're teaching your classes at the University of Pennsylvania, you're not, I can't even fathom this, you're not discussing your personal views about Israel in the classroom. Is that right?
The article that I published had nothing to do with my classes. I published it on a website called Emperor's Clothes initially, and then it was republished on Israel National News. And that's the article that documents the history of the PLO, the CHOs, that the controlling core, Al-Fatah, was created by a leader of the Final Solution. Now, that's what got them really upset, and that was the reason I was fired. Now, just to answer your question, what is going on in the academic world that it is so anti-Israel and so irrationally pro-PLO? One hypothesis that I like is that because the U.S. establishment has been pushing an anti-Israeli foreign policy, which is something that a lot of people don't want to recognize, but that's, in fact, what has been going on. And in order to convince skeptics, we have published on HIRHome.com a book that traces the history of U.S. foreign policy towards the Jewish people and the Jewish state. And I emphasize this is U.S. foreign, not domestic policy, towards the Jewish people and Jewish state from the 1930s to the year 2005. And we constantly update it as we gather more information. But we already have more than enough documentation to show that the general thrust of U.S. foreign policy towards the Jewish people and Jewish state has been consistently anti-Israel. Once that sinks in, the fact that the universities are persecuting any professors who choose to defend Israel, well, it could be that there is an effort on the part of the U.S. establishment to ensure that the universities reproduce the policy of the U.S. establishment. Supporting this hypothesis is the fact that the man who fired me, the man who orchestrated my firing, Professor Ian Lustig in the University of Pennsylvania Political Science Department, is a longtime enemy of Israel. His entire career is one attack after another against the Jewish state and one defense after another of the PLO. He explains on his CV that he works for U.S. intelligence. His first job was as an intelligence analyst in the Bureau of Intelligence and Research in the State Department, where they make sure that U.S. foreign policy, that U.S. intelligence is in line with U.S. foreign policy goals. That was his first job. And then he has been a consultant for the CIA, for the National Security Agency, for all manner of U.S. intelligence groups. So the fact that this gentleman, who happens to work for U.S. intelligence, is the one responsible for getting me fired, does suggest that there is an effort on the part of the U.S. establishment to corrupt the academic system so that the anti-Israel U.S. foreign policy will be reproduced or supported by what professors are saying.
Now, let me just ask you a question, because, you know, my instincts are that a university campus, the academic world, is an environment where different ideas, competing ideas, could be brought out, and folks could discuss them, go back and forth. I would think that a university campus, especially in the United States, would be the last place in the world that a teacher, a professor, would be fired. I mean, isn't that the function of a campus? Is where different ideas are brought out for folks to negotiate with and argue over and discuss.
Well, that's certainly the ideal. The reality is nowhere near that, unfortunately.
Now, I know this, Professor. I know that listeners right now are confused. They're confused because you said that the United States, going back as far back, we were talking about the three-quarters of a century here, its policy, its foreign policy with regards to Jews has been one that's anti-Israel. The pedestrian thinking is that the United States and Micronesia are the only two friends that Israel has. The United States is the staunch ally of the Jewish state, and whenever a vote comes in the United Nations, with a number of very notable exceptions, the U.S. is the one to ensure that Israel is not condemned, does not get in, so on and so forth. U.S. is Israel's friend. It gives it more than $3 billion a year in aid. Every president, even the bad ones, the worst ones, like Jimmy Carter, has declared openly that, you know, America is a friend of Israel, blah, blah, blah. Why, how is America an enemy of the Jewish state? How has this foreign policy been deleterious to Israel?
Well, I invite you to read our book published on hirhome.com. It's called, Is the U.S. an Ally of Israel? And you will see a thorough refutation of the view that the U.S. has had a pro-Israel foreign policy. But let me just point out a few events in that history that will challenge the common view that the U.S. favors Israel. I want to emphasize I'm speaking about the behavior of the U.S. ruling elite, which controls U.S. foreign policy. I'm not speaking about ordinary Americans. Ordinary Americans are one of the least anti-Semitic peoples in the world. There's a great many friends of Israel among the common U.S. citizenry. And, in fact, common U.S. citizens believe the same thing that a lot of Jews believe, which is that the U.S. foreign policy is pro-Israel. But let me give you just a few examples. In 1982, Menachem Begin's government invaded Lebanon because the PLO had established bases in the south of Lebanon, and from those bases, it was attacking Jewish farmers in the Galilee. Now, the invasion of Lebanon was very successful at first. The PLO was defeated, and they ended up, what remained of the PLO was surrounded in Beirut, and the PLO could have been destroyed right there and then, except for the fact that the U.S. then intervened to stop the Israeli military from doing so. And then they provided a military escort to the PLO so that they could have safe passage to Tunis, where they made their home in exile. Now, that does not suggest a pro-Israeli U.S. foreign policy. But at the time, there wasn't even a so-called peace process. Nobody thought of the PLO as anything other than one of the worst terrorist organizations in the world. And yet, here was the U.S. stepping in to prevent the destruction of the PLO, and moreover, providing a military safe passage for the PLO to go to Tunis. Now, what that's consistent with is with the view that the U.S. has a pro-PLO foreign policy. Also consistent with that view is the fact that before this, the U.S. diplomats in Beirut had their security provided by the PLO terrorists. And also consistent with this view is how the PLO process got started. For you see, once the PLO was in Tunis, they were having a lot of trouble killing Israelis. It was difficult for them because Tunis is far away from Israel. Lebanon has a border with Israel, which was much easier for them to do it from Lebanon. Once they were in Tunis, they were a little desperate for ways of killing Israelis. And this is why in 1985, there was this circus of the hijacking of the Achille Lauro in 1985 when they killed U.S. citizen Leon Klinghoffer, this poor man who was in a wheelchair, and they shot him and then threw him overboard. Now, this was a sign of desperation. They were running out of ways of killing Israelis because they were just too far. So what does the U.S. do? In 1991, President Bush Sr. and his Secretary of State, James Baker III, threatened the Israeli government for 8 months with the removal of all U.S. economic aid if Yitzhak Shamir, who was the prime minister at the time, didn't go to the so-called Madrid peace talks. The U.S. said they would get together with the Arab states and decide the future of the Middle East without Israel if Shamir didn't go. Now, this was a time when Israel needed an enormous amount of help because hundreds of thousands of immigrants were coming in from the Soviet Union and needed to be resettled. So this is the juncture at which the U.S. said, look, no more money, unless you go to the Madrid peace talks. And they were threatening them for 8 months. After 8 months of this, they broke Shamir down. Shamir went to the Madrid peace talks. And the Madrid peace talks became the platform for what became the Oslo so-called peace process. Right. What was the purpose of the Oslo process? The purpose of the Oslo process was to bring this terrorist organization created by a leader of the Nazi Final Solution to continue the extermination of the Jewish people into the Jewish state to become the government over the Arabs in Gaza, in the West Bank. And the consequence of this policy has been that over the last 12 years or so, the PLO has been indoctrinating these Arabs into the worst forms of anti-Semitism, educating little children to think that the best thing they can do when they grow up is become murderers of Jews and work for the destruction of Israel. And this insanity has been going on thanks to the fact that the U.S. pressured the Israeli government and threatened the Israeli government until it participated in the Oslo process. Now, Israeli U.S. foreign policy.
Let me ask you this question, Professor. If you're just tuning in, my guest, Professor Francisco Gil-White, Press University of Pennsylvania, could we have to obviously take apart what it means, what America's policy is. Obviously, there's the State Department. There's, I'm thinking at the early 80s, you had Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger, who just dropped dead. You had Shultz, who was Secretary of State. Those were Bechtel Corporation people. You had James Baker III, who was, you know, a country club Republican, along with Bush Sr., who was never a friend of Israel. But you have also pro-Israel forces in America, like Congress, the Senate. Clearly, both houses overwhelmingly are pro-Israel. They might be misled and misguided by prime ministers like Ehud Olmert, but it's clear that the House of Representatives cares a great deal about the Jewish state. The CIA, intelligence, they're clearly anti-Israel. American Army, probably more pro-Israel. We could divide this up. It's not just as simple as saying America, you know, all America is American foreign policy. Do you agree with that?
Well, it's true that, for example, what you say about the Senate and Congress is true. Much more pro-Israel than the administrations have been. That's true. But U.S. foreign policy is not made in the Senate. U.S. foreign policy is the province of the Office of the President. And the bodies that make U.S. foreign policy are the State Department and U.S. Intelligence. And you just told me that the State Department and U.S. Intelligence are anti-Israeli. Well, those are the organs that produce U.S. foreign policy. And I just gave you a dramatic example. It's an important example because the Oslo process is the most important U.S. foreign policy towards Israel of the last two decades, by far.
Yeah, if you just tune in, I guess
the Oslo process are gigantic. So if the Oslo process is anti-Israel, and if the U.S. went passionately out of its way to make sure that the PLO was taken out of exile and put into the Jewish state to govern all of those Arabs in the West Bank and Gaza, then the U.S. has a policy to destroy the Jewish state.
I'm not making any
of this up. The U.S.
No, you're not.
So now,
Professor, just for one second.
It's just one example.
Professor, just for one second, let me just do this. There's a breaking news piece that's coming out right now. I'm going to keep you updated on this, but rocket fire has just landed in Sderot. One house was directly hit as we're speaking. Well, we will update you, obviously, on what is happening in Sderot, but there is an attack on Sderot coming from Gaza. What else is new? A house was hit. Our initial reports here at Israel National News is that there are no injuries, but we will keep you updated on this. And, you know, Professor, here we are. We're discussing the foreign policy of the United States and the damage that Israel has done in Gaza. And isn't it interesting, everything that we predicted, that if you take the Jewish population, 8,000 Jews, throw them out of their homes, the terrorists would use these communities, 21 of them in Gush Katif, as terrorist dens, as launching pads for terrorism against the Negev, Sidoro, just northeast of Gaza, the Mediterranean coastal communities like Ashkelon. I mean, none of this is a surprise. Everything that's happening now is exactly what was predicted before the so-called disengagement. Am I right?
Yes, we did predict that. But I don't think it's a very, a very smart prediction at all. It's just an obvious prediction. And it's a prediction that anybody who was a Jewish patriot and was running the Israeli government, should have taken seriously. And therefore, the interpretation of what the Israeli government has done, in turning Gaza over to the PLO terrorists is treason. I don't think there's any other reasonable interpretation of what they did.
Let me ask you this, Professor. We only have about 6 minutes left. Would you be willing to take callers or questions for you in the few minutes we have left here? Okay, let me just say this to folks, because we've been getting a lot of requests to speak to you. You only have a few minutes. If you want to call in and have a question for my guest, Professor Francisco Gil White, his website, hirhome.com, call now. The number to dial throughout Israel, the United States, Canada, 1-800-270-4288. If you're listening to the show, not on radio, not on IsraelNationalRadio.com, but the virtual studio, you can actually right now come in and ask your question for the professor, but you have to do it immediately. 1-800-270-4288. That's the number to dial anywhere around the world. We have to do this quickly because time is running short. Just a question. What happens? You find out, how do you find out that you're in trouble at the University of Pennsylvania? And what happens? They call you into the office? I mean, what happens there?
Oh, well, they initially would have meetings with me, and they would tell me to stop doing this. Then they would send me emails threatening me, eventually with the loss of my job. When I got an email that I thought was clear enough, then I decided to confront the situation directly, and I took the evidence of the threats to the chairman, the psychology department chairman, Robert DeRubis, who promised that he would make sure that the reappointment process for my second contract, which was already rolling at the time, would be fair, and that none of these political issues would have anything to do with the consideration of my reappointment. And those are promises that he didn't keep, and I have the
That's
evidence
amazing.
To show it, and I've published it on the website.
Professor, we have a caller, Tom. He's in Washington, D.C., in America's capital. Tom, I'm going to ask you to keep your question for my guest to 1 minute, because we're really running tight on Tom. Tom, welcome to Israel National Radio. Speak loud. What is your question for the good professor?
Thank you, Javier. Professor, you're right. Did the British and the U.S. Use the Muslim Brotherhood to overthrow the Shah of Iran in 1979? And in your humble opinion, is it a possible interpretation that the U.K. and the U.S. have been supporting, or at least not doing anything to depose, the crazy mullahs ever since that time?
The fall of the Shah in Iran back in 1979, the overthrow, it led to the revolution in Iran, and that's the trouble. We're dealing with the trouble right now with the president of Iran. Was the United States, CIA, were they behind the fall of the Shah's government?
Considering hypotheses about what the real aims of U.S. foreign policy might be, we have to be very careful not to be too quickly carried away by what the official statements are, because of course governments don't necessarily say in public what they really intend to do, right? We hear all the time U.S. officials, whenever they grab the microphone or find themselves in front of a TV camera, U.S. officials will invariably say that they love Israel, that they want to defend Israel, that they'll do everything for Israel, et cetera, et cetera. But in fact, U.S. foreign policy is designed to destroy the Jewish state. Otherwise, U.S. foreign policy would not have been this passionate series of efforts to empower the PLO inside the Jewish state. Now, if there is no connection between official statements of support for Israel and actual support for Israel. I know you mentioned the economic aid, but in fact, when you subtract from that the aid that the enemies of Israel get, it really isn't very impressive. So when we're talking about official statements of enmity towards Iran, we should approach that with the same skepticism that I would endorse or suggest we should bring forward to the official claims about support for Israel. So let us not worry about whether the U.S. officials say that they hate Iran or not. Let us see what the facts are. Immediately after the Ayatollah Khomeini came to power, one of the first things he did was to absorb Savak. Now, Savak was the late Shah's security service. It was a mammoth security service, the biggest in the world after the Soviet Union's. Now, that's saying a lot, because the Soviet Union was an enormous totalitarian state, and Iran was this tiny little fifth-rate power. So to say that Savak was the second biggest security service in the world gives you a taste for just how repressive the Shah of Iran, the great U.S. ally, was. And Savak was created by the CIA. Now, and it was essentially run by the CIA. I mean, Savak had very, very close ties with the CIA throughout the Shah's reign, and Iran behaved as a feudal property of the U.S. Throughout the Shah's reign. So the fact that the Ayatollah Khomeini, who had been complaining about Savak when he was in the opposition and railing against Savak and promising to disband it and so on and so forth, well, when he took power, he absorbed it wholesale. Savak became Savama, the new Iranian security service. That's point one. Point two is that the Ayatollah Khomeini, immediately after consolidating his power, provoked a war with Iraq. Now, the Ayatollah Khomeini could not afford to provoke a war with Iraq unless he knew that the U.S. was going to provide him with weapons. Why? Because the Iranian Revolution depleted the Iranian arsenal. So he was without guns, in other words. And the Iranian arsenal was entirely, almost entirely, U.S.-made. So unless the Ayatollah Khomeini knew in advance that if he went to war with Iraq, the U.S. would supply him with weapons and spare parts, he couldn't afford to provoke a war with Iraq. And yet, that is immediately what he did. Well, what happened? The U.S. sent billions of dollars in U.S. armament every year of the Iran-Iraq war to Iran. When this was discovered in the mid-80s, it was called the Iran-Gate scandal or the Iran-Contra scandal. And despite the scandal, the arms shipments went on. Now, when caught red-handed, the Reagan administration said that the reason for those arms shipments was that so funny that the reason for the arms shipments was that the Hezbollah, a tiny terrorist group in Lebanon, a third country, had taken a handful of American citizens hostage, and because the Iranians had some influence on Hezbollah, they wanted the Iranians to beg the Hezbollah to release that handful of U.S. citizens, and that supposedly was the reason that billions of U.S. dollars in armaments went to the Iranians every year throughout the duration of the Iran-Iraq War. Now, this absurd explanation could not be true even in principle, because the arms shipments to Iran, as we now know, thanks to a congressional investigation that was done years later, that the arms shipments began in 1981. The first hostage in Lebanon was taken in 1982. So obviously the policy of sending billions of dollars in armament to Iran every year couldn't have anything to do with those hostages. And in fact, the arms shipments continued after the last hostage was released. In addition to this, there's also the fact that the Iran-Iraq war went badly towards the end for Iran. And so Iran asked for a ceasefire in 1988. Now, immediately after that ceasefire, Zalmay Khalilzad, a protege of Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was Jimmy Carter's national security advisor and the man who invented the policy of creating Islamist terrorism in Afghanistan by sponsoring the Mujahideen, whom Osama bin Laden, by the way, was training for the CIA, this Zalmay Khalilzad, a direct descent, ideological descendant of Zbigniew Brzezinski, complained out loud, I believe it was in the Washington Post, I forget which newspaper now, but he complained out loud that the outcome of the Iran-Iraq war was very bad because Iran was very weak, and that the U.S. should have a policy to strengthen Iran and contain Iraq. What happened immediately afterwards? The Gulf War of 1991 that destroyed Iraq and left Iran as the big regional power. This war was launched while Zalmay Khalilzad was policy planner at the Pentagon. Now Zalmay Khalilzad obviously is the viceroy of the United States in Iraq, and he has been responsible for crafting U.S. policy in that area ever since. In addition, the last point I would mention is that, as Jared Israel of Emperor's Close documented, the Iranians helped the U.S. in the latest U.S. invasion of Iraq. So, and I forgot one point. During the civil wars in Yugoslavia, the Pentagon teamed up with the Iranians, as is also documented on Emperor's Close, to send thousands, tens of thousands of Mujahideen soldiers. These are the same Mujahideen that Brzezinski had created starting in 1979 and then throughout the 80s, to send tens of thousands of Mujahideen soldiers to Bosnia to fight for Alija Izetbegovic and to go on killing rampages against Serbs. That importation of Mujahideen soldiers was coordinated between the Iranian government and the Pentagon. So if you look at the entire history of U.S.-Iranian relations, yes, on the surface they exchanged lots of insults, but the facts of U.S. foreign policy do not reveal an anti-Iranian policy. On the contrary. And in fact, I have an article on hirhome.com where I predict that the U.S. will not attack Iran, as a lot of people are thinking that it will. And I explain why, and I give the whole history of the U.S.-Iran relationship to support my case.
Ultimately, we have to do this very, very quick because we have so many callers waiting. Ultimately, you feel that, because Iran is very important right now,
sure is.
You feel that Israel is going to have to ultimately bomb Iran? I mean,
the problem with the Israeli government is that it doesn't defend Israel. So yeah. Whatever we think is necessary to protect Israel, I can guarantee you the Israeli government will not do it. It will do just the opposite. That would be my prediction, too. But the problem is indeed a severe one, because the consequence of the U.S. invasion of Iraq is that Iraq is becoming the westernmost province of Iran. And Iran, as the president of Iran has said, wants to exterminate the Jews in Israel. So now the only thing separating the state of Israel from Iraq is tiny Jordan. And Jordan can't stop anything. So right. The situation is indeed very dangerous for Israel. And all of this, of course, is a consequence of U.S. foreign policy.
I can tell you this. My listeners are going to go into a state of depression, probably send me the bill.
Well, but that's the beginning of enlightenment. And
yeah,
unless Israelis realize the danger they're in and the danger to their state in U.S. foreign policy, then they have no way of defending themselves. Because if you have not recognized your enemy, you cannot defend yourself. So
yeah.
What I would advise all of the Jews of the world who want to defend the Jewish state is to appeal to ordinary U.S. citizens. Because ordinary U.S. citizens have an excellent ideology, and there are lots and lots and lots of allies of the Jewish people among ordinary Americans. So if ordinary Americans pressure the U.S. government to change its foreign policy, which is attacking the state of Israel, then something can be done about the danger to the Jewish state.
We have Stuart joining us, also with the United States, Stamford, Connecticut. Stuart, welcome to Israel National Radio. You have a question for our guest. What's on your mind?
Professor, I'm a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania in 1983, and I really haven't heard you say anything tonight that connects your views of history with why you say you were fired. So while I was listening, I did a little checking on the Internet, and I found an article from you in the Daily Pennsylvanian dated February 2nd, 2004. And here's what you say in the first paragraph. I'm an assistant professor of psychology, and I believe I'm about to be fired for investigating U.S. crimes of war in Yugoslavia. Now, that was in 2004. We're well past 2 years from that. Which is it? Were you fired because of Yugoslavia or Israel, or were you on a tenure track? Were you dismissed at the end of your contract period, before your contract? I want to understand the academics of it, because these things work in a certain way. And as you probably know, there was a professor at Yale named Mary Haback, who also wasn't tenured and lost her position there, although she was a fantastic scholar. So I'm just wondering, you know, what actually did happen?
All right, Stuart. Professor?
Okay, well, the threats against me did begin with my work on Yugoslavia. This is true. I didn't delve into it here because we're on Israel National News. But the tipping point, in other words, the thing that finally caused them to threaten me that I would lose my job, was my article on the PLO. They were not happy with my work on Yugoslavia, but what really made them angry was my work on the Arab-Israeli conflict. That's point one. Point two is I was not up for tenure, not even. This was the reappointment process to my second contract as an assistant professor, what is sometimes called the third-year review. People often confuse this with tenure, but it's not. What happens is an assistant professor first gets hired at the University of Pennsylvania Psychology Department. It's initially a four-year contract. In the third year of that first four-year contract, the assistant professor is considered for reappointment to a second contract for 3 years, at the end of which the professor will then be considered for tenure. So I was not even up for tenure. I was up for reappointment for my second contract. This reappointment is something of a formality. People are very rarely fired at reappointment time, and when they are fired, it is because their performance is really dismal. There is no way you can make a case that my performance was anywhere near dismal. It wasn't even bad. It wasn't even good. It was very good. My teaching evaluations for my students were extremely high, and some of them said in the comments that it was that my course was the best course they had taken at the in the entire school. And my research was going very well. I have a very high publication rate. I publish in very good journals. I've won a couple of prizes and so forth. So you couldn't really make the case that I was some kind of problem teacher or problem researcher that they really had to get rid of. On the contrary.
You know, Professor and Stuart, thank you for joining us here on Israel National Radio. You know, I listen to you, and I listen to you describe American foreign policy. None of this is a mystery. And, you know, what comes to mind immediately is that American foreign policy has been blunder after blunder. The United States has suffered so deeply as a result of these unimaginable decisions that were made by the CIA, by the State Department, and that's all I hear. And I find myself, you know, you feel this intense anger and such, so self-destructive to American foreign policy. And now here we are, standing at the precipice, what might be a military attack by United States, Israel. Hopefully one of them will get involved against Iran. But it's failed policy after failed policy, one after another. And that's without any question why the world is in such bad shape right now, the support of terrorism. Let's move on. We have Ariel joining us here. She's also an American from Vero Beach, Florida. Ariel, welcome to Israel National Radio. What is on your mind?
Hello, Professor. You're truly an inspiration, and I just wanted to point that out. So what do you plan to do now that you lost your job? I hope I can guide you to strengthen the people's knowledge and truth. In other words, wake them up. Don't let it end here and be a very strong voice. We need you. Hashem bless you and your family. Also, you're on the same track I am on how to get my voice heard throughout America and the world. And I'm sitting here, and Tovia can tell you I've been racking my brains on how I can. I'm a pauper, I'm a citizen, and I worry about how my voice gets heard too, to get the truth out. Mike Open, Shalom.
The first question is very interesting. Are you planning to sue the University of Pennsylvania, essentially get your job back, or to be compensated for what's happening?
I am planning to sue the University of Pennsylvania. Unfortunately, that requires funds, and I haven't been able to put them together yet. But, yes, I am planning to sue the University of Pennsylvania.
She's an American citizen living in the state of Florida. She's very, very concerned about the direction American foreign policy is taking, especially vis-a-vis Israel. Going along with Ehud Olmert, I mean, what that whole speech he made to Congress, it's frightening. And you see these congressmen and senators applauding him, 18 standing ovations in this speech. And you know that these congressmen and senators, they don't mean bad. They're not trying, with the exception of a few like Hyde and others. But essentially, vast majority of them, they have only goodwill for the Jewish state. What could she do as an ordinary American citizen to make a difference? I mean, really.
There's a number of things she can do. I'd like to just comment a little bit on the premise of what you said. I'm not sure that it makes a whole lot of sense to naively impute goodwill to people. I think you should judge them by their deeds. And if the people in the U.S. Senate and the U.S. Congress really were so passionately pro-Israel and so full of goodwill, then they could do something to counter the awful anti-Israeli policies of the U.S. administration. So I think you should be a little more skeptical than I think you are about the people.
Let me ask you this, and we only have about 2 minutes left, literally. But let me ask you, I mean, when we think about people like Senator Orrin Hatch or Rick Santorum from Pennsylvania, who, by the way, if you're from Pennsylvania...
Well, no, I can't see behavior of the U.S. Congress has not been in any way effective at countering or even informing U.S. citizens about the dangers of U.S. foreign policy. To translate their official statements of goodwill towards Israel into an imputation of an actual goodwill is, I think, very naive. People always say things that they don't mean, and politicians almost invariably do so. So it is, I think, a mistake to go from public statements to imputations of intentions, especially when we're talking about the survival of the Jewish state. We have to judge politicians by their effects on the Jewish state, not by their happy statements of support or goodwill.
Professor Francisco Gil-White, I want to give you the website address again. It's HIRHOME, HIRHOME.com. Professor, this has been an enlightening interview, and I wish you, God should only give you strength, and you should continue to spread the word, get the information out, and get your job back at the University of Pennsylvania, or find another pulpit so that your voice can be heard. Thank you so much for joining us here on Israel
National
Radio.
On the contrary, thank you very much for having me, and I hope we can do this again.